I'm here.
Dear Chef, would enjoy hearing you give a discourse on pinball sometime. Pinball. I've been curious about it ever since my cousin received a pinball machine for Christmas. I understand that the game has ancient origins, but I've been unable to find out much information about the history of pinballs. What the hell makes this guy think that I have any information on the history of the pinball machine? I will tell you this. Some of the more exciting moments of my life have been spent in the immediate vicinity of a pinball machine. And I'll never forget Boles Witkowski. You mentioned pinball. I remember Boles Witkowski. Old Bo was one of the absolute greats in the pinball world. You know, we all know small immortals in our own way. You know, we knew, you know, some kid that could do something really great. But down at George's newsstand, George had two big pinball machines in there. And all of us newsboys used to work on down there. You know, once in a while when we were feeling, feeling a little flush, we'd play the pinball machine. And they had one pinball machine that was called All-American. And it had flags on it. And it had these two football teams, apparently. And, you know, it had little bumpers and the whole business with the lights and all that stuff. And you were supposed to score points. And every time the ball would go into a hole, you would get so many yards. It was an All-American football game type, say. You would get so many yards. And then if you got the ball all the way down at the bottom, it would go ding, 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 ding. It was a touchdown, see? And you could get extra points. Every time you got a touchdown, an extra ball would come up. And so, of course, the whole idea was to get X numbers of touchdowns and points, and you would win. Well, that wasn't such an exciting game. Nobody kind of dug that one. But they had another one called the 500, which was a pinball game based on the Indianapolis 500 race. And it had big pictures of cars all over the place, see? And the track on the actual pinball face of the machine where the bumpers were and all that stuff, they had the picture of the track, the big guy with the big checkered flag and all that stuff. And I can remember Boles. I don't remember how the scoring worked. But Boles used to stand in front of the machine. This is what has forever made me realize there must be something. There has to be something to cybernetics. Well, now, you know what cybernetics is. Of course, this is the relationship of man to machine and so forth. But most people think of it the other way, you see, that the machine influences man. Well, this is true. I think man is a different man than he is, you know, today than he was, let's say, in 1891. I think he's been profoundly influenced by, let's say, the automobile and a pencil sharpener and various other great things in our lives. And I know one guy that was totally influenced by a blender. You know what a blender is? You know those things where you put the ice and all that jazz in? Well, he gave his wife a blender for Christmas one year. It's been 4 years now, four hectic, hellish years. And he gave his wife a blender. Now, he was a very straight guy up to that point. And he was, you know how on before Christmas they always have these TV ads. Every year there's a new big gift, like the electric carving knife, this big one year. Well, this was the blender year. Do you remember the year when they had the broiler year, the electric broiler year? Every third TV commercial was about a broiler, where you didn't show a ham in there cooking away there, and you could do all this stuff with it. I don't know whoever all those broilers are now. I never see them in any houses anymore, but they sold millions. And anyway, he bought this blender. So one night, he was sitting there, and along with the blender came a recipe book on groovy stuff you could do with a blender. Well, up to this point, he figured what you'd made with a blender, you know, you just blend stuff. Because they never show you doing this kind of stuff on TV, you know, the kind of stuff that's really in the book. They always show them on TV, you know, putting carrots and tomatoes and stuff in there, making fruit juice and jazz like that, see? So that's what he thought the blender did. He was innocent. So he's reading this thing. And he says, "Hey, look at this here." He says, "Hey, Marge, what is this? Did you ever have a drink called a daiquiri?" And she says, "No." He said, "Well, it says you can make a drink called a daiquiri here with this thing. It says a frozen daiquiri. You know, I think I'm going to try some of that." And he reads this thing, and it's just, "You need a little rum." He says, "We don't have nothing. You have any rum around here or anything?" She says, "No, heavens no." He said, "Well, I'm going to go down to the store. I'm going to try one of them daiquiris." And so he went down to the liquor store, and he bought himself some rum. And, of course, they had ice cubes and all that stuff, sugar. And so he put this stuff all into the blender.
Bah!
You know,
bah!
Just look at this, chopping up the ice.
Bah! Yeah!
And he had this pot full of daiquiri now, see, which is what he called the daiquiri. So he poured it into this glass, and it's a little pile of ice, see, very innocent-looking thing. And you were supposed to drink it, according to the picture, with the straws. You know how they show them with the little short straws? So he didn't have any of those little short straws, but he had some real big long straws. So he cut a lot of little straws in half, and he stuck it in there, and he says, hey, Marge, try this. And so she sipped it. Well, that's not bad. Well, one thing led to the next, and his hobby became making daiquiris, as he called them. And every night when he would get home from work, he would play with the blender and make daiquiris. He tried all kinds of daiquiris. He had the banana daiquiri. He had a coconut daiquiri. He had a peach brandy daiquiri. And he had many types of daiquiris. Well, he got so interested in his hobby that he kind of stopped going to work. He would stay home and make daiquiris. Well, I don't have to tell you what finally happened to him. I better not, because it really did. In fact, he stopped even putting ice in his daiquiris after a while and didn't even mess around with the blender. He used to just go home and, you know, take out the bottle of gin, and he began to experiment. First it was rum, you know, with the daiquiris, and then he went into the peach brandy. Then he began with the Benedictine. Then he discovered bourbon. After bourbon, it was one short hop to rye. And then he played around a bit with vodka, all the while experimenting. Experimenting all the while, making notes and one thing to another. Then he went from rye to vodka. Then he began with gin. And after that, well, it was a very short hop to that door front down on 6th Avenue, where you can still see him. One of these days, you probably run into him yourself. You'll see him in the doorway down there. His one shoe is usually off. And he's sitting there. He looks like he's sprung a leak. And he's got a bottle of his 33-cent-a-gallon wine in his claws. And he looks 100 years old, at least. And it all started because of that blender. So man is influenced by machine. I'll concede that. He made daiquiris. Don't you know what is it, a daiquiri, friend? Well, it's a daiquiri. That's all I can say. Now, I'm using his terminology. And by the way, he always felt all through his life that if he pronounced it badly, somehow it wasn't doing the real thing to him. You know, yeah, if you make a joke about the thing that's slowly rotting your liver, you pretend that it isn't doing it. Like the guys that come in and say, give me a martini, kind of makes it like a fun thing. You've heard that, haven't you? Tell me the little martini there. Well, actually, what he's getting is a big slug of ginneroni. That's what he's doing. And I think that's one of the reasons why we apply innocent-sounding names to lethal things. It takes the onus off them. It's really true. Somehow a pink lady can't do much to you, can it, friend? Well, I know one guy that threw up for one solid week after one fantastic night with pink ladies. Innocent drink. Of course, they'll do that to you. Be careful of Brandy Alexanders, too. They'll back up on you like Billy be damned. I saw one guy one night sitting there with, he'd drunk about 10 Brandy Alexanders. You know, they're very sneaky. They taste like a particularly a delicious malt. I mean, they really do, you know. And he had about 10 of these things, and all of a sudden he just went, oop, like that. Just went with one sound. It came out of his ears. It didn't even come out of his mouth. He tried to stop it, see. Kept his mouth shut, but it was going to come out, man. So just thought I'd warn you that the machine can do it to you. Because there's the other thing, too, now. Man affects the machine. And I'm convinced of that. I can remember Bolus hunched over the 500. Now, I don't know how he did it. His body would move. You could see his stomach muscles moving. His hips would move back and forth. You could see those ears tense with the tremendous excitement of the competition. And I've seen Bolus score incredible scores on the 500. Incredible. And George, at one time, I think this is one of the great compliments a man can have in his life. One time, Bolus was banned from playing the pinball machine. He's just too good. That's all. Forget it. There was no contest anymore. Now, how did he do it? I don't know. I don't know how he could make that thing go in the right place. We, you know, everybody's got the same plunger. And so on. It was only in later years that I discovered how he did it. I won't tell you, because I don't want to start a rash of that. But let's put it this way. It involves magnets. Paulus was precocious. And he used to play. In fact, there was at one point, I remember, I think George owed him something like 700 games. See, he used to, if you'd win a game, you know, you'd win free games. Well, Bolus would just monopolize, as he put it. He would monopolize the whole game all night because he'd start out, he'd put a nickel in the thing and win free games. Well, then he'd play the first game of the three games, and he'd win 28 games. And by the time 8 o'clock would show up, he'd maybe have 70, maybe 100 games that George owed him. And finally, George would say, look, here, take it in nickels. Go, get out. And he would give Bolus the nickels and throw them out. And he walked tall among us. Because my role always against the pinball machine was to feed it. I'm a born feeder. Other guys are takers. You hardly ever make transitions between feeding and taking. Remember this, for every taker, there's 25 feeders. Right, Tony? And I mean in all phases of life. All phases.
This is WOR, New York.
Man, I'll tell you, you know the old expression, you can't get blood out of a rock? Can't get blood out of a turnip? This station has proven that to be false. Totally. We got a turnip right there in the next studio. They've been getting blood out of that poor turnip for 10 years. Got a faucet now on his side. He just turns it on. Blood comes out. And serene. You mix it with the orange juice around here. So, you never heard of that drink? Oh, you're going to hear a lot of things tonight.
It's Alexis Lachine time, and let's see what the copy says. Are you one of those people just beginning to enjoy wine? I'm the devil, and I'm here to tell you about Alexis Lachine, which is an elegant French wine. In fact, it's a high-quality French wine.
Well, the reason this guy writes me this note, I'm going to tell you a story now. You ready for a story? I think that from the very beginning in our lives, we're just walking around squirts. I mean, almost too small to even have traumatic experiences. You know, you have to be a certain age to begin to have traumatic experiences to recognize something bad is happening to you. Nothing is going to traumatize you if you don't recognize it as bad. And there's a certain point under which you don't recognize things. That's why you see a 2-year-old kid, he can sit and look in the face of a lion. He doesn't know. That's right. Just a big kitty, you know. So, but then you read enough about lions, and you know something about lions, and the next thing you know, this big fat old lion walks into your pad one night and stretches out, starts looking around for a snack. Well, that's a traumatic experience. You never get over it either. A true traumatic experience, you can kind of salve it over with the psychologist and the analyst and all that, but you never get never erase it, ever. Like my kid brother had a fantastic traumatic experience in the service. He never got over it. He once in a while wakes up giggling at 3 o'clock in the morning when he thinks of it. And it was this. He was working a high power transmitter in the Himalayas, which is in Burma, or at least that was the part of the Himalayas that were in Burma. And he said, you know, every morning he'd get up and he'd look over there and he'd see Mount Everest sitting over there, and K-27 and the Sherpas and all that stuff. Yeah, they were all there where he was, see? And he said the Sherpas would come down once in a while. He said they drank yak butter. He said, nothing like a good eye-opener in the morning with rancid yak butter. He says, that'll stop you right there quick. And he said they'd bring in yak butter and a curdled gnu milk. He said, that was always good. He said, then, and he said they used to make a wonderful... wonderful after-dinner sweet out of coagulated yak blood. He said that was always a good one, too. Now, I'm just telling you what they eat over there. So I don't get mad at me. You'll not hear this stuff on the cooking shows on TV. But these things are cooked. And so one day, Randy, he was on late night. He was on midnight. His job was to run this big 50-kilowatt transmitter, which was in a little transmitting shack in the jungle there in the Burmese jungle at midnight. And he would go out at midnight. He was a sergeant. He would He would get his flashlight, and they turned the transmitter off, say, something like 6 o'clock in the evening, and it was down until midnight, and then they would turn it on again. It would work all the way through the day. It was this big, high-powered Air Force transmitter. And so one night, the transmitter, by the way, was in a shack that was up on pilings, you know, how they do in the jungle there to keep, the cockroaches from eating the tubes and stuff like that. And so his transmitter was up on the pilings there, and it was all screened in. It was very hot there. It was Burma. So he got up one morning. He got up about 11 o'clock at night, actually. He was on the night shift, and he had a sandwich, you know, Spam sandwich they have there. And he's not knowing he's about to have a moment that he will never forget. You know, I think most of our most fantastic moments are come without any warning whatsoever. That's what makes them fantastic. I mean, if you're told you're going to have a traumatic experience next Wednesday at 2:30, it turns out then not to be traumatic because you're all set for it. You know, it's the thing that you're not ready for. So Randy's sitting around there picking his teeth. He is very hot. He's wearing nothing but GI shorts, you know, that kind of thing. And he's got it covered with mosquito dope and salve and jazz like that to keep away the heat rash. And he goes picking his way through the jungle path down to the transmitter. Yeah, very calm, like anybody else. He'd been there for 3 years. He'd seen everything, you know. He was now half native, you know. He spoke a little Sikh. He'd speak a little like Hindustanic and all that stuff. Almost didn't speak English anymore. So he walks up the steps of this little shack. It's pitch dark, and they had a little light switch off to the side there. See, they're generating their own juice there. So he throws the light switch on, and so he walks over and he stretches a little bit. And well, another day, you know, another 30 cents. You know, after all, he was in the Army. So he walks around, he takes a look at the transmitter. They had meters, you know, to tell whether the filament voltage and all that. So he starts throwing on the filament voltage and stuff like that. And he's looking at the big panel there. And boy, and he's kind of tired, and his eyeballs are hanging out. He had malaria for 2 years, you know, all that stuff. So he's just dragging away there. And he turns around and he looks back of him there. He was going to pick up the log, which was on the desk. You know, they kept the log of their operations. And he turns around to pick up the log. And he sees something behind him. He said, first, didn't register. He just looked. And then he thought, well, it's just that damn malaria that's starting again. I'm going to have another attack of malaria. You know, what happens when you get malaria, when it's really working, you tend to hallucinate. You know, you get that fantastic fever. You tend to see things in the dark. And you do, you know, it's true. Have you ever had a bad case of some kind of virus or something? You find yourself out of your head. You know how people use the popular term is out of your head? You know, it's kind of hallucinating there, and you're having fantastic nightmares. Well, Randy figures he's going to get another shot of malaria. So he turns around. He said, first I didn't. So he turns back to the transmitter. He had discovered any time he started to see things because of his malaria, to concentrate on what you were doing, and it would go away. So he turns back, and he's turning on the plate voltage and stuff like that. And then he looks to see if the hallucination is gone, and it ain't. It's starting to get up. It was at that point that he realized he did not have malaria. What he had was a 12,000-pound tiger who was sitting in the transmitter shack and who had just discovered my kid brother was made out of succulent bacon. And he's just starting to sit up, see? Randall went out through that. He shot through that door. He says, yeah, it's unbelievable. He's, you know, Randy always was very athletic. He says, but I want to tell you this. He says, I discovered that I had untapped, completely unplumbed athletic abilities. He said, first of all, I broke the world's record for broad jump. He says, because I left my feet. He says, I went right through the door. And he says, I landed halfway back on the way to the barracks. He says, that was a good 75 feet. He says, now that was the first jump. He says, my next three strides took me right through the barracks, and I was halfway on down to the service club. He says, I was taking 40-foot strides. He says, I went right down. He says, all of a sudden, it hit me. You know, he may be after me. So he says, I turned around. Hollered, there's a tiger in the transmitting shack. He says, with that, all the other GIs jumped up, you know, staggering around, yelling and hollering. He says, there's a tiger in the transmitting shack. Well, what a shepherd just ran through. Tiger. He says, they came pouring out with their, you know, their sidearms. Everybody had a sidearm. He says, the first action they've seen in years, you know, they all come pouring out with Thompson submachine guns, 45s. He says, guys were falling out of bunks, and guys were falling up and down the stairs. And they got a big flashlight. They went back to where the tiger was, and he says, you should have seen it. He says, that tiger obviously decided that, you know, he better clear out, he said, because the tiger went right through the screen door. He says, a big hole in the screen door. And he says, and that tiger just went right through it. And he says, all the guys are, you know, kind of disappointed. And at the same time, they were scared. They were glad he was gone. And he says, you should have smelled the smell, a strange feline smell in that transmitter shack that that tiger left behind. Just a smell. He says, you ever smell the Burmese tiger when it's being a tiger and is not being an exhibit in the zoo? That's another kind of tiger. And he says, man, was he big. He says, you never saw anything. Big, flat face. Tremendous. And he said, for weeks after that, out in the darkness, he says, you could see him. He's circling the camp night after night. He would circle around. He says, you see these two big green eyes. That tiger. And he says, no, you know, that's been some time now ago. And he says, he gets nervous now even at this point when he gets around a cat. You know, just 3 o'clock in the morning, he wakes up, he looks up at the ceiling once in a while, he thinks his old malaria is coming back, and he can hear the sound of a tiger stretching. He says, that's the first sound he heard. He says, you know, when a tiger stretches, see, have you ever heard, he says, it's truly cosmic knuckle cracking. The tiger stretched. You know, I'm getting a little stiff. It's time for dinner. He's popping his shoulders, and he says, oh, there he is, right over there. It's my kid brother. Well, now, these things are traumatic moments. That's a traumatic moment. And I had a traumatic moment that involved a pinball machine. I just want to introduce you to traumatic moments. And I have never told this story, because it is painful. Some of the most painful things that you've had in your life seem trivial to others. True, Tony? That's right. And, the glove fits both hands, let's face it. Other people's terrible moments seem totally trivial, if not irrelevant to you. And they are, I suppose. But I never gamble anymore because a terrible thing happened to me one day. Never gamble. Nope. You're listening to a man of exemplary habits. I go past Aqueduct without even so much as a side glance. The big A means nothing to me. Nothing. The little B, nothing. I have not even bought a New York lottery ticket. I just don't buy none of that stuff. You know why? I think a little mood music wouldn't hurt here. Now hold it there, Tony. I'll give you the cue though. I was 8. I know it very well. I know how old I was at that time because other things which are beyond the scope of tonight's course. Now, when you're 8, you're in a very peculiar position as far as mankind is concerned. You're not a baby. And so you don't get away with stuff that babies do. If you're 8 and you squat down and let it go, you're liable to get in trouble, right? Okay. But on the other hand, being 8, you're not expected to hang in there like, say, a kid of 15, right? So you're not a baby. You're not an adolescent. You're nothing, really, when you're 8. And nobody writes stories about kids being 8. They're always writing stories about kids being, you know, a tortured adolescent. That kind of jazz. Now, I think it's far torturous more to be 8. Because you just have got no lobby going for you at all. And people tend to, on one hand, give you responsibilities. On the other hand, they tend to think you're too dumb to do anything about it, see, which is probably true. And it's the period whenever you go to the grocery store, you have to take a list, you know, written down, which you give to Mr. Oscherschlager. And your mother keeps saying, bring back the change. Tell him to put the change in your mitten. Right? You know that? It's kind of humiliating. Well, one day, we better set the mood for this. It was a day of evil portent. Yes, it was a day like any other day. The sun came up and the sun went down. There were clouds floating high over the Indiana landscape. It was a winter day, like all other winter days, cold, rotten, and crummy. I was a kid like any other kid, faking it. And I was sent to Oscherschlager's grocery store. for one loaf of silver cup bread, 15 cents worth of sliced summer sausage, a small jar of Hellman's mayonnaise, and two cans of Campbell's tomato soup. So what, you say? What's so great about that, you say? Well, if you're that kind of Philistine, you will never understand the moment that occurred shortly after I arrived in Aschenschlager's grocery store, about to learn a lesson which has never left me. Aschenschlager's grocery store nestled next to a vacant lot that had a large Sherwin-Williams paint sign in it. Aschenschlager, a man who created monsters. Yes, play them sad violins, sing them sad songs, blow them horns for all the lost and gone opportunities of a feckless youth. Yes, the saxophones of night blow their evil, hollow siren song, luring us on to the chasms of disaster. Not bad, eh? Not bad, you say. You reset that, Tony. We're going to need it. So I headed down towards Aschenschlager's, and my mother gave me $1, a dollar bill, to pay for the stuff that I was supposed to buy. Now, the dollar bill was nicely folded up in the note that contained the list of jazz that I was supposed to bring back, including a loaf of silver cup bread, which I remember distinctly because it later played a bad role in this tale of disaster. And she folded it up in the note, see? So I take the note down to Aschenschlager's, and I'm standing around down there. And there were some people ahead of me. I was just a little kid, see? Some people ahead of me. And they're buying stuff. And I saw Kazimir Wisniewski was there, too. He was buying stuff. And Mr. Aschenschlager put the change from his stuff in his mitten, and he went out with his little bag of stuff. And so finally, Aschenschlager looks down at me and says, "What do you want?" And then I remembered that I had this note in my mitten, which was in my left mitten. And by that time, a large lady with a mustache had shouldered her way in, and now she was buying stuff. And Aschenschlager's back in business. He's paying no attention to me. So I pull my note out of my mitten, and I see this dollar bill in my hand. Okay, there it's beginning, right? When you take a, you know, I tell you, money can do more bad stuff to people. I mean, I think money, on the one hand, money is beautiful. On the other hand, money is evil. There's a love-hate relationship between money. The typical hippie who's putting money down all the time is standing on 6th Avenue down there on 8th Street with his hand out for you to give him some. I mean, if he didn't like money, he shouldn't be asking me for any, right? So there you are. That's love-hate all the time, that green stuff, man. And so I had a dollar bill. And I'm standing there with the dollar bill in my hand. And on the counter, right next to the cash register, Mr. Aschenschlager had an infernal machine. Now, I'll have to describe this machine to you. It was an upright thing that had little nails in it, driven in the top of it, all the way down. See, right down the side, had little nails. And at the bottom, it had about five different designations. One said 5, one said 10, one said 25, one said 50. And it was a little kind of a chute at the bottom of it, and a plunger. And at the top was a slot. Well, I'm watching this thing. I had never seen it before. When I see this guy, this big kid, he was about 15, he's standing around, and he walks over it, and he puts a nickel in it. And it goes, ding, 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 ding. The nickel goes right there. You can see it. The nickel's going down through the nail. See, ding, 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 dong, 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 bong.
It goes in the 25 slot.
The kid says, "Hey, Oscar Schlager, you owe me a quarter." And there's nickels right there in the 25 slot. Oscar Schlager looks over and says, "Oh, okay. All right, just a minute. Don't hold your..." I can't tell you what he said, but he said, "Okay." And he reaches into the cash register and gives the kid a quarter. The kid puts another nickel in. Goes ding, 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 ding. And it goes in the zero slot. At which point, out came a green ball of gum. Well, I'll be darned. I never saw a thing like that, see? At which point, the kid takes his ball of gum and goes out. He now has a ball of gum, 25 cents, and he spent a dime, which isn't bad. So I got a dollar in my hand. Mr. Oscar Schlager comes over to me and says, "What do you want, kid?" And I give him the dollar. He says, "What do you want me to do with this? Do you want change? Is that it?" And he hands me a dollar's worth of change. Because he was busy. He didn't know what he was doing, really. What he was doing was forever shriveling the soul of an innocent victim. So I take a nickel and I put it in this thing at the top. I just put it in. It goes ding, 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 ding. Boing, 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 boing. Out came a yellow ball of gum. Well, I figured on the next one, I would get a quarter. So I put in another nickel. Ding, 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 boing, 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 boing. Out comes a green ball of gum. I do not have to burden you with the rest of the sordid tale, except to point out that in less than 10 minutes, the entire dollar had gone down the drain, and I had roughly 15 various colored balls of gum, which were now stuck in my right mitten. I would put them in my right mitten, and I was a left-handed pinball player at that time. Oscar Schlager comes over finally and says, "Well, what do you want?" He says, "Well, give me the note." "Oh, hit me, the note." I take the note and hand it to him. He says, "Well, where's the money?" I said, "Put it in the machine." "So I can't give you no bread without no money." He says, "What am I going to do?" I said, you think I'm in for charity here, kid? What do you think I'm doing here? You put it in a machine, you don't, come on, give me the money. You got to get some more of the money? Where's the rest of it?" I said, "Put it all in there." He says, "You mean to tell me you put all the machine?" He says, "Look, you got to have 2 cans of tomato soup. You got to have, what is this, a fresh silver cup. What is it? Was your old lady think I sell nothing but, does she think I sell stale bread fresh? Why does she have right fresh on here? Fresh, forget it. I'm not going to give you this for nothing." And more people come pouring in. And I start to get that sick, scared feeling. My God, oh, my God. This is a supper. I spent the supper money. I go back out of the store now, and I'm scared. Have you ever had the feeling of being scared to go home? You were really scared to go home. So I stood out next to Oscar Schlager's store, and it's getting darker and darker, and I didn't know what to do. I'm scared. And it's getting cold. All of a sudden, the door opens. Out comes Oscar Schlager. I've been out there like a half an hour. And he says, "Hey, listen, your old lady just called. Asked me if you were still here. Why don't you get home? Go on home. Don't stand around out here now. Get home. Your old lady's worrying about you." I wanted to ask him what he told her. I was too scared to even do that. So finally, I figured, this is it. I got to go. So I went back home very circuitously, up and down through the alleys. And by this time, my old man is home. He came home for supper about 5:30, 6 o'clock. I had left the house not later than 4 o'clock, maybe. The old man, I rarely got home after my old man, you know, unless it was some kind of a thing at school or something. And he's sitting in the kitchen there reading the paper. I come into the kitchen, it was hot. My mother says, Oh, so you finally got here. All right, she said, put the bread over here.
I got no bread. She didn't even look at me.
She says, all right, come on, put it over here. Let's go. Go in and get washed for supper. You're late for supper. What are you... You know, always messing around. Now, the next time you don't come home from the store, I'm going to... You're going to really get the business, you know?
She... I go in my bedroom. I got no bread. Nothing. I don't have no soup. I don't have anything.
It was at that point that I embarked on my life of crime. I don't want anybody listening now to say anything about it because, well, I just don't want you to mention it. My brother had a green turtle that he got from my Aunt Gwen for his birthday, like 2 years before, and the green turtle had a slot on his back. And it was my brother's turtle bank. And every time he had a birthday or something, or my Uncle Tom gave him a half a dollar or something, he would put it in his turtle bank. And his turtle bank was heavy with half dollars and stuff. Now, my kid brother was out in the kitchen, you know, just walking around whining. And I saw the turtle bank. The turtle bank, we had this chest of drawers that had Bozo the Clown and all kinds of people painted all over it. You know, it had the Snoopy and the Seven Dwarfs and everything on it. And on top of it was the turtle bank. I took down the turtle bank, and on the bottom of the turtle bank, there was a rubber plug that you could pull out. I pulled out the rubber plug, and I started to shake it. And out came some quarters and some dimes and some half dollars. I had a whole handful of them. I stuck them in my sheepskin coat and put the rubber plug back and put the turtle back on top of the chest of drawers with Snoopy and the Seven Dwarfs all over it. I then left the bedroom, and instead of turning left to go into the kitchen, I turned right, which took me through the living room, out the front door, down the steps to the porch, out into the cold. 30 seconds later, I'm back in Aschenschlager's store. I am buying silver cup bread. I am buying 2 cans of Campbell's tomato soup. I am buying a couple of Twinkies for me because it's on Randy. I am buying Hellman's mayonnaise. I now have it in a bag, and I notice in my glove, I still have like 35 cents left over. So I put a nickel in the thing, and it went ding, 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 ding. I got a blue ball of gum. I put another nickel in. Ding, 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 ding. A yellow ball of gum. It was just about that moment. Just about that moment. That I realized that I was not a gambler. And the great fear that was down in my gut was slowly being banked like an ancient fire of hell. At least I had the Campbell's tomato soup, and I had the silver cup bread, but I had stolen my kid brother's birthday money, the money that he was saving for the time when he was going to buy an airplane. Said he was going to buy an airplane, and then he never did buy the airplane, you know. 10 minutes later, I'm back in the kitchen with a bag of Aschenschlager groceries on the sink. You're sitting down to supper, but I am unclean. My brother innocently sitting there shoveling in the meatloaf, drinking his Campbell soup out of a Shirley Temple mug. A victim. Cain and Abel all over again. My old man, sitting there drinking his pap's blue ribbon beer, does not know he has sired an evil person. An evil person. My mother over there stirring the mashed potatoes, dishing out the grape. To this day, they don't know about it. So don't come and ask me about pinball machines and give you a history of pinball machines. They have led many a man down the track of perdition. Maybe just as well I lost that night. Had I won, I could be standing around this very day with a checkered vest, a seedy character carrying the morning telegraph around with me every morning, hoping to win again sometime. And so in each man's life, there are the gathering storm clouds, the howling winds of last year's typhoons, screaming over the desolate baseland of the desert of time. And so tonight's program, as it was dedicated to Ed McMahon, another great man of our time, was choreographed by Jerome Robbins. The Technicolor photography was by Natalie Kalmus. It was directed by Elia Kazan. We wish to thank the Yugoslavian Army for their great cooperation, without which this picture could not have been made. And we dedicate it to our clerk typist, whose unstinting and unremitting and tremendous activity brought about this entire creation. So stand tall, friends, pull in your gut, think a clean thought before tomorrow, and thank God, it may just do it for you.